dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A naval intelligence officer is a good man to talk to about such things, former in this case, but a man who also served his country in a number of other capacities, including in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, and as an assistant secretary of state in George W. Bush's administration. His name is Robert Charles. He graces us frequently, and we're always appreciative of his time. Bobby, thank you for joining us today. Listen, you are monitoring a lot of the things that we're particularly concerned about, and I know your team at the Association of Mature American Citizens, for whom you are a spokesman, is as well. People can find out more about that terrific outfit and find your writings there at amac.us. What did you make of this parallel town hall situation last night? What were the principal takeaways as far as you were concerned?
You know, I'll tell you, Frank, it to me is a spectacle that's indicative of where we are in the nation. You had really a lack of integrity by two different large journalistic organizations, and they were putting it on full display. On the one hand, you had President Trump put in a position where he had to debate and was talked over repeatedly by a news anchor who really isn't a news anchor. I mean, really was a partisan clearly in the process of trying to embarrass him. And I think he acquitted himself very well. He was thoughtful and he presented the facts, but it wasn't, I mean, I guess he knew what he was getting into, but it wasn't in any way, shape or form fair, balanced or a display of integrity on the part of the media. On the flip side, you had Biden confronting really softball questions intentionally, the integrity issues and actually now seemingly criminal issues related to his behavior and his son's behavior were not even raised by the moderator in that one. And it turns out, this morning that we learned that some of those were preset questions by Biden partisans. So, you know, I think we're witnessing a time in American history, Frank, when I think we have to be doubly vigilant. You know, C.S. Lewis once said that an education without values creates just a more clever devil. And I think what we're looking at right now is a media establishment that has wholly lost its way. It's become partisan in ways that I've never seen in my lifetime. And I do wonder what's behind that.
Yeah, I talked about it in my commentary today, Bobby. It's a situation that I think would have the founders of this country spinning in their graves when they thought that the press could be relied upon to be everybody's, you know, cross to bear, but that it would hold everybody accountable and therefore was entitled to the privilege of very free speech and free press. Let me turn to one other topic that that was touched on, even somewhat peripherally in the course of the debates, such as they were, the town halls, I should say. And that is what seems to be increasingly shaping up as an effort to deprive the people of the opportunity really to have a free and fair election in which their votes will be counted properly and the person that they choose to be president of the United States will actually become our next commander in chief. And I wonder whether, Bobby, you've got a lot of time in the government, including on the law enforcement side, if this is fundamentally going to come down to not just voting fraud and election hijacking and all the rest, but actual seditious conspiracies, including the use of violence, this is entering very different territory entirely. And I wanted to talk to you about it because I know you've also spent a lot of time overseas where you've seen these kinds of things, not only roiling countries, but bringing down governments. Talk about it.
You know, you're absolutely right to point this out, Frank. I spent time managing the worst, our law enforcement related programs and rule of law programs in more than 70 countries. And those were always the worst countries, the countries where they needed the most help. Ranging broadly from Kosovo to where you can pick your poison, but they were very difficult countries. And public corruption, aggregation of power and violence were often tied to drugs, but generally those three things, aggregation of power, public corruption, and a default to violence were things that instantly created instability and sustained instability. What I worry about here is you see aggregation of power in the form of this Twitter and Facebook and other media outlets essentially finding themselves in a position where even though they're supposed to be acting pursuant to law and pursuant to public forum, equality and fairness and not monitoring or changing content, that's not what they're doing. They're actually taking sides, and that's dangerous. The second thing you see is this public corruption piece, and I must point again to the Biden, his latest emails. I mean, it is shocking to me that Twitter wouldn't allow those things to be recirculated, but it's doubly shocking because when you read them and see that the president, the vice president of the United States, the man who would like to be the president, was directly involved in lying to the American people about the abuse of his own office on behalf of his family, both in China and in Ukraine and in extended locations. To me, it's just shocking. That is public corruption 101.
And on a very high order, too. It's not just, $50,000 here or there.
Well, we're talking about billions of dollars flowing as a result of the misuse of his high level. I mean, this is what they imply. So I think it's very shocking in a way that the American people are not being well served by the media establishment. Again, I come back to the notion that most of these people were never trained in ethics. They jumped into it, made money, decided that they would find a way to promote a cause that they liked, which is the Democratic Party. And it's become the Democratic Socialist and increasingly just the Socialist Party. But it's a sad turn of events in terms of aggregation of power. And the last part that worries me is this preponderance or continuing preponderance of violence as a means of political dialogue. We do not tolerate, go to the Supreme Court opinions, we do not tolerate violence as a means of political dialogue in this country, and it's what distinguishes us as a country of peace and a beacon for the world. We respect the freedoms of our fellow man, and unfortunately, we seem to be drifting away from that dock, and if we drift too far away, it's hard to get back.
I'm not sure we're drifting. I think we're under power, and heading away from the dock at some speed. And the thing about it is, and this is the subject of my monologue today at our new television program, Securing America, which you can find at securingamerica.tv, is this is now not only countenanced, this use of violence as a form of political expression is not only countenanced, Bobby Charles, by senior Democratic Party officials, including, at the very least, the vice presidential candidate and arguably the presidential candidate as well, as something that is part of their approved playbook. That it's all good with them, and therefore it seems assured that we're going to see, as this so-called transition integrity project sort of mapped out in a recent war game, them actually instigating violence as part of the, you know, chaos that they seek to help them assure an electoral outcome that may not actually reflect the will of the American people. So this is so very troubling. And I think, Bobby, what is so appreciated about the work you do at AMAC.us and Fox News and on our programs, of course, and elsewhere, is you're helping to put the spotlight on the true character of who these people are and who they're working for and to what ends. And that is something that I think, if it does indeed stack up as a seditious conspiracy, has to be dealt with as such and right quick. Bobby, we have to let you go, I'm afraid, my friend. Thank you so much for your time today and all the work you do, your service to our country, which continues now at amac.us. Come back to us again next week if you would. Next up, we'll delve a bit deeper into the true nature of these enemies within with former CIA operative Charles Sam Faddis. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back and joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very proud to say. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He is, by my lights, a Renaissance man who has rendered very commendable and extraordinary service even to our country over many years. He served for a time as an assistant attorney general out in Washington State. He was in the United States Army and as a clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency, operated in a lot of miserable places around the world on our behalf. He also ran for Congress in the state of Maryland. And not least, he is a very accomplished author of fiction and nonfiction works, including Beyond Repair, the rise and fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sam Pattis, it's good to have you with us, always. Welcome back. You are, among other things, the driving force behind a terrific online resource called andmagazine.com, Sam. And you had a stunning report there the other day, and I wonder if you might just share with our audience its contents and whether it's gotten much of a reaction, because it certainly should at a moment, not least when we're being endlessly hectored about the possibility that Donald Trump might not cede office should he lose this impending election. This was an issue, of course, in the town hall last night a bit as he went back and forth with the moderator, the so-called moderator. But tell us what the Democrats apparently were doing back in 2016 with respect to the peaceful transfer of power.
Right. So the article that you're referring to at In Magazine is based on my interview of a source who at this point doesn't want to be named, but is a former senior official in the Pentagon who was in place during the time of the 2016 election and then following that. And the official had a number of things to tell us. Probably the most noteworthy was that roughly a week after the election, the official was contacted. This is through official channels. This is not some sort of back channel thing. It called up on the secure phone by basically the front office of the Pentagon, and it informed that he had been named to be part of a committee that was being stood up in the White House. Again, this is 1 week after the election of Donald Trump, and the purpose of the committee was to focus on the, as the source says, the storyline and the timeline of the Russian collusion narrative, and then explicitly told that one of the tasks the committee would have would be to look at delaying, not proceeding with, pushing off the inauguration of Donald Trump, to begin the planning for the possibility of not transferring power to the president-elect.
So the idea would be, presumably, to use this pretext, now known as the Russia collusion hoax, as a justification for not fulfilling the direct will of the American people, you know, as formalized in the 2016 election, Sam?
That's exactly right. That is precisely what the source says. I should add that the source was taken aback, would be way too mild of a term to use, stunned, staggered. And even though he remained formally part of this committee, deliberately avoided ever attending any deliberations of the committee, but was in fact included on the classified email traffic concerning its activities thereafter, and so saw that they proceeded with this narrative. And then at some point before the inauguration, the committee's focus shifted to, okay, we're not going to do that, but we're now going to focus on laying the groundwork for impeachment, basically.
You know, Sam, this is so shocking in a way, of course, but I remember vividly watching that inauguration and really holding my breath right up to the moment that Donald Trump finished the oath of office. Because I had just a sick feeling that, not knowing any of this backstory, mind you, or really at that point, the true nature of this hoax, but that this group of radical leftists that made up the Obama-Biden administration, many of whom were on that dais behind Donald Trump as he took that oath of office, would, you know, do anything in their power to prevent him from achieving it. And so here we are. Thank God for your source. I trust he is credible. And I do hope, Sam, that somebody's doing something about this revelation. Do you have any evidence of that?
I have zero evidence that anybody's doing anything about it. And this is maybe the most terrifying aspect of the environment we now live in, right? Which is, you watch what's happening with the Hunter Biden emails and the increasing evidence, not just that Hunter was getting paid, but that money was in all likelihood going into Joe Biden's pockets. And yet, much of the media just nothing to see here, just complete deafening silence, just killing it by not addressing it.
Well, I addressed this in my commentary today, Sam, that this is so fundamentally at odds with what the framers of our Constitution envisioned in giving the press the kind of freedom that it has enjoyed for, you know, two centuries now plus. And it was on the assumption that they would be, you know, honest arbiters and hold accountable everybody. And it's clearly not the case any longer. Which brings me to another problem, Sam, that you've also been addressing at End Magazine and elsewhere, including, I'm pleased to say, on our new television program, Securing America. Namely, the apparent confusion, to put it most charitably, of our frontline homeland security agencies about the nature of the threat we face here inside the United States, what I think of as the enemy within. Talk a little bit about what the FBI and Department of Homeland Security are insisting is that threat and what it means if they've got it wrong.
Well, of course, last week, Department of Homeland Security came out with this threat assessment, which included sort of a domestic threat assessment, and a big portion of that was focused on domestic violence extremists, I think is their terminology, domestic terrorists, and managed to conclude that the number one threat to the country right now in October of 2020 is from right-wing white supremacist groups. If you actually look at the fine print and look at their statistics, you realize that they say, buried in the sort of the footnotes, that this is all based on data only through the end of 2019. So they've somehow released this document in October of 2020, knowing very well that everyone will take it as a current snapshot, and then left themselves a backdoor to say, well, that's 10 months out of date. Obviously, nobody published that document in October of 2020 with any illusions as to how it would be received. And, you know, without dismissing the threat of any group on any extremist wing or white supremacists, how anybody could look at cities that have been on fire for 6 months, but torched by communist Marxist organizations, admittedly bragging about being Marxist organizations, and then with a straight face tell us that the number one thing we have to worry about is white supremacist groups. I mean, it's not unintentional, it's deliberate. And quite frankly, I would also... it's political interference, and honestly, I think the reality is they deliberately the FBI, DHS, stay about 10 miles away from any leftist group. It's like a third rail. They don't touch it.
And when you say leftist, I think it includes the green part of the red-green axis, the Islamists who are allied with the left, and now increasingly it seems under Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Turkey, likely to become more and more players in this insurrection or revolution. Sam, just one point that I thought was really important in your analysis of this so-called threat assessment by the Department of Homeland Security at End Magazine is an observation about the size of the number of violent incidents that were being examined, and how that can be terribly misleading in terms of the overall impact, especially if it's out of date. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's the old expression right there? Lies and statistics. I mean, the Department of Homeland Security provides these statistics, X number of incidents. Well, let's see, we've had almost 4 months now of endless incidents every night just in the city of Portland. Buildings burned, police officers assaulted, people executed on the street. Probably right there is several thousand terrorist incidents associated with left-wing domestic violent extremists, and yet they show up nowhere in DHS's statistics. It's absurd.
And I think what you were pointing out is that in 2019, there were a relatively, thankfully, relatively small number of violent incidents. And it can skew the curve, as they say. Sam, this is so important. And we appreciate what you bring to this, which is a lot of hard experience inside government, because for the vast majority of people, including what I think is a very informed audience here at Secure Freedom Radio, is that there's a tendency to, even after all that's been going on with the FBI and other federal agencies, John Brennan's CIA, for example, that has caused a lot of reason to be very dubious about the work, at least at the senior levels of these agencies. We're inclined still to credit them and be guided by them. And if the Department of Homeland Security and FBI are truly not focused on the actual enemy within, heaven help us, because it's going to be more active and more dangerous, and I'm quite certain a lot more violent in the days immediately ahead. So we appreciate your warnings of all of that. I know you will keep coming back to us with more updates on it, and I hope people will be consulting frequently your website and magazine.com. Bless you, my friend. We'll talk to you again next week. We're going to continue this conversation, though, a bit with another of our duty experts on the subject, Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm always pleased to say we're joined by a distinguished member of the Center for Security Policy team. His name is Kyle Scheidler. I've had the privilege of being one of his colleagues for a long time. These days, he is directing the Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Project at the center, and recently was a very important witness in a hearing that Senator Ted Cruz convened to try to drill down on who are we up against in these violent uprisings, insurrection, revolutionary activities, whatever you would like to call it, across our country. And Kyle acquitted himself well in the face of criticism of Mazie Hirono, but he's in good company, it turns out, when it comes to Mazie's criticism. Kyle, it's good to have you back. Welcome. So I wanted to pick up on sort of a theme that I was talking about a moment ago with our friend Sam Faddis about why is it, Kyle, as a close student of these matters, that, you know, the people who seemingly are supposed to be reliable frontline defenders of this country against enemies, both foreign and in particular domestic, are seemingly so clueless about the Marxist and, you know, well, jihadist to some extent, character of the threat that is upon us at the moment. Your thoughts?
Well, I think a lot of it, Frank, has to do with the transition in the government from counterterrorism to this countering violent extremism concept. Now, the Trump administration has put a lot of effort into trying to move from violent extremism to what they call terrorism prevention. But the reality is that the bureaucracy has been very resistant to doing this. They still use the same old terms. They still think about it the same old way. The problem with the violent extremism concept is, while it purports to be focused on ideas, the ideas behind violent acts, the reality is they don't give any credit to the meaning of those ideas or how those ideas affect the behaviors of the groups that organize around them. So they treat all ideas as sort of meaningfully equal. And this makes you unable to understand where the threats are coming from, why they behave the way they do, why they make the choices that they do, and in general makes it you unable to explain to your fellow Americans what is happening and why. And so that's where we are now with a lot of the FBI and DHS.
Do you think, Kyle, though, that there's something else at work as well, and that is that there are some ideas that are more equal than others, I guess, to paraphrase Orwell, that in short, there are some ideas, particularly those of the left or those of what I think of as Sharia supremacists, that these professionals in various agencies, certainly at the senior level, if not the working level, just are, you know, intent on not seeing, not addressing, not understanding, and therefore not acting effectively upon.
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. I mean, we see this with the most recent DHS report, which they put out, where they highlight white supremacy as the most important threat facing the nation. Now, this comes as, you know, Antifa anarchists and Black Lives Matter supporters have caused over $2 billion in damages around the country from violent riots and have killed numerous people. But they don't count those incidents as any kind of threat. They're only looking at violence that led to fatalities. And so what happens if you have a number of terror attacks and one of them causes a mass casualty incident, as we had in, I believe it was El Paso last year, then you get a spike for your white supremacists, and then you run with that story, and that becomes the story that the media is interested in. It's not done by any real basis of analysis as to what threats actually are, what they're capable of achieving, and so on.
Well, and also, I think it's important to note, Kyle, as Sam did a moment ago, this is last year's data. You know, it predated all of this recent mayhem, which has clearly been operated by others. And there's also this other, you know, point. I think it's important to observe that the folks who are engaged in this kind of violence aren't making any secret of who they are and what their larger purpose is. I mean, when they talk about burning down the system, for example, that is, I believe, in intelligence parlance, a clue as to what they're about, isn't it? So I think it really raises a question about, can we have confidence that those who are supposedly monitoring these kinds of threats and protecting us from them are actually up to the job?
Well, that's right, Frank. I mean, fundamentally, the first job of the government is to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. And so if Antifa and these other Marxist revolutionaries say that they intend to burn down the American plantation and overthrow the government, they are a grade A number one threat, even over and above threats that may lead to loss of life, because you're talking about the loss of the entire American system and the American Constitution. And the irony, of course, is that the FBI was founded to deal with this very threat, with the Palmer raids in the 1920s, and they have gotten very far afield from what they're supposed to be doing. You know, in their 2010 primer, the FBI describes anarchist extremism, which is what they call this, as primarily a threat to be responded to by locals. They see it as merely property damage and vandalism, which, of course, you give low shrift to. If you consider it what it really is, which is a threat to the Constitution, an attempt to overthrow the government, well, then you would position it much higher on your list of threats, but they don't do that because they don't understand the threat correctly.
One question that I think is on a lot of people's minds, Kyle, when they hear this back and forth, is probably, there's something illegal here, isn't there? Why is the FBI and the Department of Justice, whatever their understanding of the ideologies or ideas of those perpetrating it may be, why are they not much more aggressively prosecuting those who are responsible? We hear about some arrests, but we don't really hear much about them translating into taking these people off the street permanently, perhaps.
Well, I mean, if you look at the situation we had recently where Attorney General William Barr very correctly called on his prosecutors to make big cases, including seditious conspiracy cases. And seditious conspiracy is a crime where you use force or the threat of force against the government in order to overthrow it, which is literally what is happening. And of course, you know, people within the bureaucracy immediately ran to the Washington Post and leaked the story on him. And that's just what's been happening all 4 years, essentially, with the Trump administration as they try to guide the government as they were elected to do.
But again, you made this point very well a moment ago, and that is, whatever the politics of the individuals who are leaking this kind of information or otherwise trying to sabotage the president or his cabinet appointees, they have a sworn duty to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and faithful execution of the laws pursuant thereto. And this just does seem to be a case, again, of malfeasance and perhaps, you know, a criminal misconduct on the part of those who are failing to do their jobs. Let me turn to one other thing, just to go back to something you touched on earlier, Kyle, because I do think it's so important to understanding how we've gotten so far astray. You are an expert on the jihadist elements in our midst, the Muslim Brotherhood most especially. Talk, if you would, Kyle, a little bit about how countering violent extremism was really engineered by the Muslim Brotherhood's influence operators during the, I guess a little bit to, during the George W. Bush administration, but really full force during the Obama-Biden years, and how that's kind of put us in the position we are now, where we're relying on the Southern Poverty Law Center, of all places, it seems, for data about who are the violent extremists. And it turns out the only ones they can count are white supremacists.
And frankly, they're not very good at counting them either, because they overcount them. But when counting violent extremism was created, it was done really in partnership between the late stages of the Bush administration, early Obama administration, and members of the Brotherhood in the United States.
Some of whom were actually inside the government of the United States at the time. As I recall, they were some actually on the payroll and some were advisors.
Literally on the working group deciding these policies. And they wanted to separate and sort of bless their behavior, Islamist subversion, and make sure that the government was focused only on things that went bang. And of course, the problem you have when you do that is you can't keep up, because the Brotherhood is to use the government's term, radicalizing, I would say indoctrinating, people at a much, much faster rate than you can arrest terrorists. And so you will lose if that happens.
And a country like ours is particularly susceptible, is it not, to influence operations that are not violent. It's the pre-violent sort of phase of what the Brotherhood's up to that's so worrying at the moment. We'll see what they do about violence. But that's missing fundamentally the character of that particular threat as well, is it not?
Oh, it is, of course. And it gets, again, to what I said earlier about the government's sort of inability to protect itself, because it has gotten away from this first principle responsibility to defend the Constitution. That includes defending it from subversion, which has been always one of our primary weaknesses. It was a weakness that the Soviets saw. It was a weakness that the Islamists saw, and they have taken advantage of.
Big time. And it seems as though we're in for a lot more of it in the days ahead. Thank you so much for the work you do on all of this, Kyle Scheidler, as the director and senior analyst at the Center for Security Policy for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. We look forward to our visit with you next week and on the television program, Securing America, as well. Thank you. Good to talk with you. Next up, we'll speak with Peter Husey about a whole nother problem, namely the adequacy of our nuclear deterrent in the face of a number of concerted efforts to take it down. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. And as always, it's a pleasure to have with us Peter Husey, one of the smart guys on a lot of things in the national security space that other people simply aren't not paying enough attention to. He is the director for Strategic Deterrence Studies at the Michel Institute for Aerospace Studies. He has been for many years one of the hosts of an important salon series for government officials and congressional staff and others interested in nuclear deterrence and related issues. And it's always a pleasure to be able to catch up with him. Peter Husey, welcome back. Let's talk a little bit about the state of our deterrent. There seem to me to be a couple of really serious threats to its effectiveness, Peter, and maybe we could go through each of them quickly in turn. One is the obvious one, and that is that enemies of this country, nuclear armed or incipient nuclear armed, perhaps, enemies of this country, are on the march in terms of amassing capabilities that would be highly destructive to us and perhaps render our deterrent ineffectual. Talk a little bit about those threats, if you would.
Hey, interesting. I've just been doing threat analysis of what North Korea, Iran, Russia and China. I have called them the Brothers Mayhem. And it's what I think Secretary Mattis once called them. But here's what's going on briefly. Since we signed the New START treaty with Russia, they have deployed or will deploy by 2027, 27 new types of cruise missiles, ICBMs, sea-launched ballistic missiles, submarines, and bombers, as well as what is called an exotic torpedo, long-range torpedo, all of which will be nuclear-armed, some of which, or most of which, will be under the New START treaty, but some of which, about four systems, will not be captured under the treaty, depending on one's interpretation. That's Russia.
Peter, let me just stop you there for just one second, because you and I both were imprinted by the Cold War. If we saw a buildup of that magnitude by the Russians, we would be at, I don't know, DEFCON 3, I think. It's a very serious problem all by itself. And then you're going to get into some of the others as well. But that would it not be considered a very, very alarming situation?
They are serious when it comes to nuclear deterrence. Someone once said that after the end of the Cold War, they were a nuclear deterrent with gas stations with nuclear deterrents, with huge numbers of nuclear weapons. It means you better keep your powder dry, and there's there's a huge risk if we would stop building and stop modernizing. So this allows the Russians to build up to what my friend Jim Howe and Mark Schneider have said, somewhere around 4,500 warheads compared to the around 2,000 allowed under the treaty. As long as we can cover the targets, our STRATCOM people and our administration today can deter, but the future is what's problematic. Now, China. According to my friend Uzi Rubin, who is an Israeli missile defense specialist, he says China has tested more ballistic missiles in this last year than all the rest of the world combined. That's number one. We do know from the Defense Intelligence Agency that China is projected to double within the decade we are now in their entire nuclear arsenal to somewhere around 600 to 800. But again, there's no transparency, and that is one of the reasons the president has pushed to get them into discussions on arms control, not because we're going to sign a deal going down to their numbers or they're going to come up to our numbers, but to get them to be transparent and put their numbers on the table. Will it happen? I don't know. But of all the nuclear powers on the UN Security Council, they're the only ones that have no transparency whatsoever. So that's very worrisome, because even the Russians think, some Russians think, they may have not 300 warheads, but may have somewhere around 1,500 to 1,800. Okay, North Korea. The good news is that the huge ballistic missile they paraded in Pyongyang this week is liquid-fueled, meaning it takes time for them to fuel it. We'll see it. But the bad news is it's on a mobile launcher that is bigger than anything we've ever seen that they got from the Chinese. Plus, it apparently gives them the ability to put more than one warhead or multiple warheads on top of the missile. That's not good. With respect to Iran, what's even more interesting is Iran, like China, has tested more ballistic missiles than any other country in the Middle East and has deployed more ballistic missiles of all kinds than anybody in the Middle East and exports them to their friends Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthi in Yemen. And they can ring all U.S. military facilities and those of our allies in the region. But the key is what Uzi Rubin said in a recent report. When he looked at their space launch capability and their testing, they are going for what he calls a global nuclear armed missile capability. And what he means by global, meaning they can reach around the globe. Are they there yet? No. But again, bad guys don't tell us what their timetable is. They just go do it.
Peter, so there are two other things that I want to just quickly touch on you. In addition to the emerging and intensifying threat from these four countries, we have the problem of the obsolescence of our own arsenal. And when I say obsolescent, I don't mean just that it's old. I mean that it's maybe inadequate in terms of its deterrent effectiveness. And secondly, that there is a tendency on the part of some who seem likely to be influential with a Biden-Harris administration to pursue the further diminishing of our deterrent through unilateral disarmament. Talk about both of those as concerns as well, if you would.
I think our current arsenal is capable of deterring the Russians and the Chinese, but as our strat commander, as our vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs have said and warned, this doesn't happen automatically. Unless we modernize and replace the systems, we are going to, as Admiral Charles Richard of STRATCOM has said, we'll be out of the nuclear business. He says, there's no choice. There's either you modernize or you're out of business. Our ICBMs today, 60 years old. Our B-52s are between 50 and 70 years old, depending on what model you're talking about. And our submarines are getting to be 42 years old, which is the longest we've ever put a submarine in the water. So that's your answer to your question about, yeah, they're old. With respect to the proposals made by former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry and his disarmament group friends, they have proposed the following: wipe out all land-based ICBMs, which is 400 of our 700 allowed nuclear vehicles. Number two, cut the number of submarines from 12, which we're building, down to 6, which means at most you'd have one or maybe two or three in the water at the same time, which would cut our deterrent by at least 2/3. Third, they want to cut up to 25% of the bombers, and get rid of the long-range strike option, which is a fancy name for a cruise missile, which means our bombers would have to penetrate Russian airspace or Chinese airspace, and it takes an awful long time to get there. They're great instruments of power, but the missiles that bad guys got can get here in 20 to 30 minutes. It doesn't do you a whole lot of good if your bombers are going to take multiple hours to get to where they're meant to go, and you've diminished the ability to strike from offshore, outside the territory, so you don't have to go through air defenses. So the proposals made by some people who used to work in the White House for Vice President Biden are following these lines. And my worry is, the idea is, if we show restraint, the Russians will show restraint. Well, we haven't built anything since 1997, when the last B-2 bomber was built. And the Russians have not only not shown restraint, but they have gone, and I've just did the analysis, they're deploying about 1.8 new nuclear type systems per year, which is exactly the number they were producing during the height of the Cold War.
Peter, we're almost out of time. I just wanted to say, Admiral Charles talking about us going out of the nuclear business sounds pretty much like what these guys have in mind. And it obviously is the case that they have forgotten what a former Secretary of Defense by the name of Harold Brown, who used to work for Jimmy Carter, famously quipped about the Soviet Union: when we build, they build. When we stop building, they keep building. Goodness, this is a formula for disaster. And I think it's so important, Peter, that we have this conversation now before we hire a new commander in chief, to know whether this is in fact what Joe Biden, who has had his own, I think, delusions about arms control and about disarmament by the United States, to say the least, to say nothing of Kamala Harris, actually are thinking, actually would propose to do, and actually have as an overall ambition here, because it will perhaps define the future security of the country and our people. Peter Husey, we have to leave it at that, I'm sorry to say. I will have you back soon for a further conversation about all of this, but thank you for setting the stage for it, and let's hope we can get a proper debate going, and I mean real debate going, on these issues in the days to come. God bless you. Take care, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.